everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Humans of LinkedIn, where every story is worth hearing. I have with me today Chris Hughes. I don't know Chris. My business partner was like, hey, you got to have this guy on your show. And I was like, no. And he goes, all right, well, I'll take the company. And I said, okay, fine. I guess I will. So Chris was gracious enough to come on the show. We've never talked before, which is how I like it here. So we'll get things straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Chris is not a horse, but it's a saying people say. Chris, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it.
How did you get to know Patrick?
Yeah, actually, it's talked through Lunch Club, the networking app.
He mentioned that to me.
Yeah, it's nice, man. I've seen a lot of those platforms, and they're pretty iffy at best. But the way they run it, and like the way that they establish connections between people, is pretty cool. And I've had some great conversations on there. I think it's one of the better ones.
How does it work?
Yeah, so you sign up, you kind of give a bio about yourself, where you're located, and they're only in a handful of markets. So I think that they kind of look at regionality too and try to pair you up with somebody that's relatively close by or is in another one of their big markets. But you just say who you are, you know, what you're looking for, if you want it to be like a networking opportunity or, you know, find out about a new project or business development or whatever it may be. And then they try to establish a conversation.
Are you looking for a man or a woman, like, you know, certain body mass index, right? So are you in Chattanooga?
No, I'm in Austin. Austin.
Okay. So, you said geographic, so I was like, well, Patrick's in Chattanooga.
Yeah, a lot of times, most of my conversations have been with people like in Dallas or Houston or, you know, somewhere around here. But yeah, it set us up. It was cool. It was great. Had a good nice conversation.
Yeah, Patrick, he's all right. I don't know. I'm thinking about replacing him. So what's your deal? Like, what is it that you guys do or you personally?
Yeah, I'm a content strategy consultant based here in Austin. So I've worked in content marketing, digital media, you know, kind of leading writing teams. I was director of content operations for a big digital publishing network for about 4 years. So yeah, I work with solopreneurs and small businesses on content strategy and, you know, helping them get that standing up. Decrease lead acquisition costs, just, you know, kind of build that organic traffic engine. So really try to give them more simplicity in their lives, especially for solopreneurs, because, you know, they're wearing every hat under the sun. Doing all the things. So
is it just you, or is it is it your company and it's just you doing it? Or
yeah, I kind of sprouted out to do this on my own. You know, I've really had my last full-time job in this world last year, and I've had a couple of contracts with local companies here this year, and just really kind of made the decision, partially triggered by the virus, but more so just like wanting control over my life a little bit more at this point in my career.
I don't understand how, I mean, that's going to be the norm in 10 years. I mean, I don't actually understand how people can still go to a job. Like, I get it that it's like, you know, stable, but it's not. Right. And let's see, I'm 28. I got out of school 5 years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
And within 2 years of working in the industry, I was like, this is I was a sales guy, but even it didn't matter. Even any of the people I knew, I was like, there's no such thing as a stable job. Like, are people still acting like that's a thing? Like, all the people in the companies are like, come work for someplace where you feel secure and safe. And I'm like, you mean where like their employment is tied to their job performance review every 6 months, where you have somebody who doesn't even know who they are come in and like check a bunch of boxes? Like, it's freaking insane, dude.
Yeah, no, like the whole notion of like loyalty and stability from our parents' generations is gone. I mean, it just flat out doesn't exist anymore. Especially in Texas, it's an at-will state. They can let you go for just not liking the way you look when you come in one day. You know, I mean, they don't have to build a case. There's nothing that surrounds that. So, you know, drop of a hat, that's that. You know, you can be gone.
I mean, you never know when you're going to wake up and be like, you know, I think I'd look good in dreads. And your boss is like, what are you? Get out of here. Anyway, so that's cool, dude. No, I totally get it. That's why we started this company because we watched a marketing agency here in Indiana basically fleece a company we both worked for like $100,000 to like rebrand them and build a website. And it was like the most garbage thing you could imagine. I mean, I was like, what on earth is going on here? Like, my business partner was he came on right after the site got built, and he spent the next year rebuilding the site that they just paid 40 grand for.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, unfortunately.
No, it's not. Well, so we're like, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed right out of college. And we're like, is it, what's going on here? And then, you know, within a year, we're like, oh, this is just what website agencies do. They just steal people's money.
Well, you know, I think agencies are weird, you know, and I've kind of, you know, in doing what I do, I maybe underprice a little in comparison to what an agency would do, but then I try to over deliver on, you know, what I charge because I'm aware of the agency model of coming in and
right
pie in the sky, we're going to do everything for you within 3 to 4 months. You're not going to believe what we've done to your site. You're not going to believe the traffic you've received. And they just, they're salespeople primarily. And they're really good.
Which, you know, is ironic, right?
Yeah.
Because they're selling their marketing services.
Right. You know, and if it works for them, it works. I mean, can't, you know, say too much bad about it because it's a sustainable business model. But I mean, that's the reality of those types of relationships a lot of times.
Well, it's sustainable for, I mean, it's sort of sustainable for the business itself, but it doesn't actually do anything for the client. And that's what's like, that's what's amazing to me is just the insane amount of marketing companies out there that are like running everything off the idea that like you're going to pay us for performance and then hiding behind the fact that you're going to have to wait 6 to 9 months to see that performance. So they basically are just like, we're just fine with churning a client every nine, like we just churn our clients every 9 months. We make $5,000 a month off of them for that period of time. And we go find more. I'm like, this isn't even a company. Like, what are you, like, you're not selling anything.
That's the reality of like of organic traffic. And if you're going to do it off the backbone of SEO, I mean, it's going to take 6 to 9 months.
Yeah. Or
longer, so that's, I mean, you know, that's, it's kind of a weird situation because like, if you're finding somebody that really wants to go that route, they need to have that awareness. And like their return on investment is not going to be instant. It's going to take some time and, you know,
for sure. So have you always been in content? Like, have you always been a writer or?
Yeah, basically. I got my master's in sports management from UT, from University of Texas back in 2004, and I worked in pro sports for a couple of years and really had the intent of going that route and figured out like long hours, low pay, pretty fast. Going to have to move constantly, so I'm like, I don't know. Shifted and started to write a lot more and built out my own blogs and sold those and worked for another network. And then through that network, kind of made some more networking connections and worked for Wide Open Media here, the big digital publisher, for about 4 years as their director of content operations. And they were just acquired by Publishers Clearinghouse. So was part of an acquisition there. It opened up a little bit of potential possibility for me to, you know, to start to build something for myself.
Gotcha. Awesome. We have Beth Crosby jumped in here and she said, so true. SC is also at will. Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, I'd much rather have that. I mean, I'd rather be at will because then I can protect myself too. But it does just create that environment where it's like you're better off working for yourself. I mean, the stories of these companies that just, you know, when there's employment law, you basically are completely at the mercy of the employer, and it's nuts, man.
Well, they know a lot more detail of what all that entails and how they're protected than we know as employees. Right. So. Right. Of course.
Right. And then like, do you want a job? Okay, we'll sign this thing where I own you. And if you quit, I own you for the next 3 years too. Oh, but I can fire you and then I still own you.
No, especially with non-competes, right? Like non-competes,
right.
You know, whether, you know, depending on, you know, how much they can really be enforced, they're there to protect the company.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I don't understand how those are legal, like just under the Constitution, like just the... Like the basic right to work should necessarily mean you can't ask me, you can't tell me I can't have a job if I don't sign a piece of paper that's a I don't get it, dude. I don't get it.
That's wild.
So yeah, I mean we've done content for a little bit too. We're moving to mostly websites at this point, just because for us, we've been spread too thin, right? It's one of those things where like we want to help people. And so it's like, you know, they're like, hey, can you do this thing? Hey, can you do that thing? And you're like, yeah, I can do that thing. Yeah, I can do that thing. And I like writing, right? So like we like creating a lot of our own content, but content's expensive, man, right? So it's like, I don't want to make crappy content, and you can go buy a 1,000-word post from some clearinghouse for $80, right? So it's like, unless I'm going to put in real work to make this stand out, in which case I got to charge you like $500 because it's going to take me 8 hours, right? So it's like, it's just, it's a, for small businesses or really even bigger businesses. They're like, I don't want to pay you $5,000 a month for content. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, I think, you know, where my client base comes from, particularly with like solopreneurs or people who are kind of at that point in their career where I am, and they've got like a side gig that's been on the back burner for a while. And they've been thinking about pulling the trigger on it, and they finally decide to, and they've got a little bit of capital to work with, and, you know, therefore we can dig in and get to work, you know. But yeah. I mean, you pay for what you get in the content world. It's that.
Oh,
simple.
Yeah.
I've seen some awful stuff. Awful. I mean, like, it shouldn't be on the internet, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, or it's like clearly something that's like, that you know that they're changing like a couple of words and selling that to everybody. So it's like, you know, now you're just going to hurt your SEO. What, like, from your perspective, because I mean, I'm genuinely curious about this. Like, if somebody was saying, all right, in 9 months, I've got a website, but I don't have a good blog. Mm-hmm. In 9 months, I want to be capturing search traffic. Like, how much activity has to go in, right? Like, how many posts are they putting up in a month, right? Because I see so many different numbers, but like, from, you know, what are you seeing work?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a proponent of trying to publish at least once a week to your blog, like to your company's blog or your brand's blog, especially like in the first 30 days, just to kind of get in a pattern of, you know, getting that content published, but then like turning that focus from inward to outward and going and trying to write as many guest blogs as you can for about 60 days. And that's for domain authority purposes purely, you know, along with other link building tactics, but like trying to go and land high domain authority backlinks back. So you get your domain authority to a point that you're going to be competitive at all in the niche, because if you're just writing on your own blog all the time and you're not getting any backlinks coming in, it's pointless. So I think it's kind of that mixed activity. And then you kind of return back to your blog at like month 4 and then kind of do the hybrid approach of, you know, you're writing on your blog, you're landing some guest blogs and doing some, you know, really starting to dig into social at that point too. So you have the social signals, but I even think that like social media is pointless for the first 3 months of a blog's life, because kind of yelling down an empty hallway, there's no audience. So you want to build your audience.
Yeah,
later,
that makes perfect sense. I love that. Yeah. And I love that approach of like, cause that's something we've struggled with just even on our own blog. Is like, what's the allocation, right? Like, we've done high volume, like there's like for the last few weeks, maybe like 6 weeks, I've been trying to do like 3 a week. Like, cause I've seen a lot of data that like, if you can get 12 in a month, like that's huge. And so I was like, all right, hey, well that's, but so I dropped from doing like like 2 2,500 blogs to trying to knock out like 3, like 800 or 900 word blogs. Right.
Sure.
And that's another question too, is like, where's the word count coming? Because I guess the thing for me is there is so much conflicting information. So it's what is working, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about all the conflicting information. Like, no matter what you want it to be, you can get that confirmed. There's a lot of confirmation bias in terms of that. So,
I want to write 800 word blogs. All right, well, I can figure out how to make that true.
Right. So basically, you just have to pick what works for you and stick with it. I tend to not write anything that's less than like 2,000.
Okay. Okay. Like that's what I'm curious.
1,700, 2,000, especially for guest posts, because I want to do a good quality job on a guest post and want to make sure that they get some traffic and, you know, there's a good potential there. So I tend to write those a little bit longer, even like 2,000-3,000 typically.
Okay. That's good to know. Go ahead.
They're benchmarks, you know, who knows? I mean, you have to pick something and stick with it.
Right. Well, right. And consistency, I think, is everything. I mean, where we had landed was I was trying to keep everything at I found a post by, was it SEO Journal, or it was one of those, you know, websites that's got all this content. And he'd said that basically from this guy had done like some pretty in-depth research. And it was one of those things where it wasn't like Google data. He was like researching the similarities between posts that are ranking at the top of everything. And he came to 1,760 words as like the, like that was the average of like all the blogs that were like right around that top tier of thing. Like they all were right. Like basically between 1500 and 2000 was the sweet spot. And I was like, all right, I think that made sense to me, because I also find that I can write a compelling blog post in 1500 to 2000 words.
Right.
In 1,000 words, I always feel like it's not going, I'm not actually helping anybody. And once you get over 2,000 words, I'm like, all right, this guy's totally not paying attention anymore, right?
Yeah, and that's hard, right? Because you want to make sure that you're not, that you're covering the subject enough in depth. We also don't want to bore people to death. And
right, for sure.
Because attention span-wise, they're probably not going to go halfway down the article anyhow, you know?
Right.
You know, and on the flip side of all this, like the big trend right now is 10X. You hear everybody talking about 10X content, 10X this, 10X that, you know, notion being instead of doing like four blog posts in a month, you do one that's like 12,000 words and you just beat that topic to death. And that, you know, just because of the length and because of the fact that that article is so much different than anything else that's out there, it's going to get more attention organically. You know, who knows? Yeah. Maybe.
Right. You're like, yeah, and I'll believe it when I see evidence of that that's what's going on.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, Backlinko is a really good SEO site. And, you know, the guy that runs it, Brian Dean, that's all he does. He does like one massive 12,000 word post a month. And, you know, he has all these, you know, data to back it up that it works for him. And that's fine. But I think it's trial and error like anything else. You just have to figure out what works for you. You
know? Well, and I think also the other thing that's missing from a lot of those, because you go to those sites and like, here's what's working for us. And I'm like, yeah, dude, but you've also got a 10-year-old blog. You've been in the space forever. Google loves you, right? Every other article that shows up is you related to your to what you do, right? Like that's not, that doesn't mean anything for someone trying to get off the ground, which is almost everyone.
Well, yeah. Right? I mean, those legacy blogs are going to rank well just because they're legacy blogs. I mean, that's, you know. And then the content world, the SEMrush and Ahrefs and, you know, search engine journals of the world are always going to get the nod because they've been doing it and putting out they have full 6, 7, 8 full-time content writers. Must be nice.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So let's shift from boring business stuff to you. What do you do for fun? What's your family life like, or, you know, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I grew up in West Texas, man. I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, kind of in the middle of nowhere up there in between Denver, Albuquerque, and Oklahoma City, kind of equal distance between all of those. So, you know, Bible Belt, you know, pretty conservative place. You know, obviously, I live in Austin, so you can make your assumptions about where I stand on those things in comparison.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You grow up there, it's a lot of old money, you know, oil money, cattle money. You know, it's kind of one of those places. It's a little bit stereotypical Texan when you hear about what Texas is. That's really true of that part of the state. And so you kind of grew up with a little bit of kind of that baked in inferiority complex, you know, kind of imposter syndrome.
Your belt buckle wasn't big enough.
always fighting that, you know. There's like 5 or 6 families there that really kind of run the show. And if you don't have one of those last names, you've got to uphill battle.
Interesting.
That's kind of, you know, what I grew up with. But, you know, that said, you know, fought through. I played basketball at a pretty high level, played high school ball, played at Trinity University in San Antonio for 2 years, played the Division III level. So really worked my way up to that. And yeah, you know, that's sports are still kind of a part of my life, but not so much after I got out of the industry and, you know, kind of backed away from it. So a little bit more casual sports fan these days, but I'm a big home brewer. I've been brewing beer for about 10 years and I like to brew quite a bit with the club here in Austin, and we're semi-serious about it. We're not terrible now after a decade.
Like you got like a group of people that are like home brewers.
Yeah. We brew together like once a month. So,
all right. What's your poison? Like what's your favorite brew?
Just brewed a porter. We've got
I love that.
Got 2 massive pecan trees in our backyard and like hoarded all the pecans and gonna try to turn it into a pecan porter. So,
nice. Like you mean like growing your own fresh pecans in your backyard. That's
yeah, legit. They drop this time of year and like I've got them all in a bag. There's probably 4 or 5 pounds.
Oh my gosh. I've never had a pecan porter. Is that a common flavor, or like is all porter made with pecans? Is that a stupid question?
No, like they're pretty common down here in Central Texas because there's a ton of pecan trees. A lot of the breweries have done them over the course of time.
Nice. Is that like how do you fit the pecan? Like how does the pecan flavor get into the beer?
Yeah, so you have to crack all of them and then roast them. And then you want to make sure to pull all the oil off of it, because if the oil gets into the beer, it really hurts head retention. So you won't have like much of a head in the beer when you actually pour it in a glass. So you want to get all the oil off of it. So once you roast them, you put them on like a paper bag, and the paper bag pulls all the oil off. And then you put them in like a fermenter and put the beer from primary fermentation onto all the pecans. You just like rack it on all the pecans and let it sit for a week, and all that flavor filters through.
Wow. So they just sit in and then you drain them out.
Yeah, then you just bottle from that container pretty much. And
wow.
That's that.
That's so cool.
Let it sit for 3 or 4 weeks. The hardest part when you're doing something like that is patience, because you want to crack into it. So you have to.
Right. You want to get that beer. Yeah. Okay. So because I've always had a mild fascination with home brewing. Like, is the kind of thing where unless you just have a passion for it, it's not worth getting started? Or is it something where like with just a little bit of upfront and time investment, you can figure some stuff out and like get a batch going? Because I need it to be easy to start with. Otherwise, I'll never go through.
Well, there's three levels. You can do like extract only, which is all, where the sugar is just kind of in like a syrup, basically. You can do mini mash, which is like partial extract and partial grain. And then there's all grain, and all grain is what the breweries do pretty much.
Gotcha.
So it's like level investment as you go up the chain. You can get extract kits from like a homebrew supply place, and they'll give you a recipe sheet, and it's pretty dummy proof. I mean, it's straightforward. There's not a lot to it. Everybody starts with extract only, and then you kind of work your way up.
Okay. So the extract part is like the hard part, like they're like shortcutting a part of the process, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So they've just have pulled all the sugar off of all the grain and diluted it down into the syrups. So you just use the syrups and the boil, and it's a lot easier because there's less temperature control. Like the farther you go up the chain, the more temperature control it is, and like the more specific each piece in the process has to be. So it's a lot easier to start with extract. And I did that for probably 3 years and then switched to doing mini mash. And I don't have the space or the money to do all grain. There are these guys that have like these ridiculous, $10,000-$20,000 setups in the basement of their house.
Oh my gosh. Is that where they have like a legit, like one of those legit barrel tower things and like.
Yeah. Like the conical fermenters and like
the
$3,000, tanks, and stuff like that. And that's guns. I mean, like if you're in a relationship, like how in the world are you able to do that?
Right.
You could never get by with doing that.
I know. I've got a son, and it's amazing to me. I see these people like on YouTube or whatever it is. And I'm like, if you had a family, this would be impossible.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is my YouTube sensation. I have a family.
that's kind of the running joke on the homebrew groups too, is like, how? Like, how can you do that? Like, how do you get by with that?
It's so funny. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, the joke is like in the running story is you do it because it'll be cheaper than buying the same amount of beer from the store. And it's just not true, but that's like the story that the guys tell.
I mean, it's because I drink enough beer that I need a 500 gallon vat of it. And my $20,000 investment over the life of me will pay for it.
But it's interesting, like, see those guys make that investment and really get good at it. And, if you're willing to do that, you're kind of have it in your mind to maybe try to open a brewery.
Getting pretty
close, and you're really wanting to dial it in to the point where you might give it a shot, because otherwise,
why would you be putting that much effort in? I mean, I do home studio production. Like I work on like my own songs. It's probably my biggest hobby / cool. Like I would like to legitimately like release, like, I'm close to something that's like releasable. Right. So I want to have some songs I put out there, but what's funny about it is like, it's the same thing. You get these guys and you can spend $500 putting together a little home studio, or I could right now, if somebody gave me the cash, I could spend $100,000 without even blinking. And I'd still be like, oh man, there's still more gear I want. It's just funny when like it's that way for everything. Like my brother-in-law was telling me the other day that he wants a $1,200 mower. And I was like, is it like a riding mower? He's like, no, it's a push mower. And I was like, what? I was like, why would you want a $1,200 push mower? And he's like, well, cause it, like the cut that it gives, like it has like some kind of pristine blade thing. And I just, it hit me. I was like, everybody's got their thing, right? Like,
oh, yeah,
he'd look at me and be like, you spent $1,000 on a microphone. I'm like, yeah, I wanted to spend 10.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, that's, you go down the rabbit hole real fast, man.
Right. No, for doubt. Sure. No, for doubt. Sure. That's cool, man. All right. So I like to wrap up the show with something that's maybe like a life lesson or something you live by. Like what's like a, you know, whether it's a saying or a motto or just a general way that you like to live your life. Like what's one thing that kind of sums up the way you look at things and the way that you try to be a human in this world?
Sure. Control the controllable, I think, is the biggest one for me. You know, I've learned throughout my career, you know, I'm 43 to be 44 at the turn of the year. And, you know, over the last 15 years or so in the work world, really have figured out that you can control what you can control. You know, really be active and work for yourself and always be building for yourself, because you never necessarily know what's around the corner, and those are the uncontrollables. So, you know, my advice to anybody kind of getting started or, you know, kind of fresh in the business world is always be building for yourself and be thinking about plan B. You know, what that looks like, and always have something you can fall back on and have as a second option when life happens, because it happens.
Nice.
You know, so I think that would be my biggest piece of advice.
Awesome, man. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on. I love that. Maybe we'll have you back on sometime soon, but looking forward to connecting with you more offline and just, you know, having you in our network. So anybody, how Absolutely. Can people, if somebody needs content, if somebody's interested in what mm-hmm. you do, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn constantly. I create a lot of content on there. So just slash Chris Hughes. And then my website is chrishughes.com. So KRISHUGHES.com.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on, Chris. We'll see you guys next time.